The first thing that I can remember is being pushed in a pram into Hollywood, County Down. And I gather that's pretty far back to go because I was probably only about 9 months old. But I can literally remember going down the hill in the pram, looking at my mother pushing the pram at the back.
Wow. And would your mom have spent a lot of time in Hollywood? Because that was away from the business and away from probably where you were. Where did you live, sorry?
No, we lived at Marino, which was
okay,
wasn't, which
no,
wasn't
around
far,
the corner then, yeah.
Just around the corner, so it was quite close.
Happy days. And tell me about the family business, because I think that's a fascinating...
Yeah, the family business, J.P. Corey and Company, Timber and Builders Merchants, started by... Well, many ancestors back. 1814 was the time it was started. And we were then down at Prince's Dock at the start and moved up to the Springfield Road in 1963.
Mm. And you were part of an interesting part of local history then, because being where you were and being at the time you were up there?
Well, that's right, because then I joined the business and the trouble started 2 months after I joined the business.
Wow.
And I remember standing on the roof of our drying kilns for all the hardwood that came in from Africa, listening on a lovely August evening to the sound of gunfire across Belfast. And it was a roar, and I reckon there were something like 4 shots per second going off. And I just, as an 18-year-old, thinking, what is this? What is going on here?
That's crazy. Like, that's a very clear difference between you and I, is when I was 18, the Troubles was not happening. When I was born, you know, I think I was born the year that the Good Friday Agreement was signed.
Yeah.
And so my experience of 18 and your experience of 18 was vastly, vastly different.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. So what did you do in the family business? What was your first job?
I was literally put behind the counter to write out customer orders when they came in. And I did all the basic stuff because there was no way I was just going to be privileged and put into position. I had to earn my keep there.
Sure.
And then I worked up in the different departments, learning about the timber and the plywood and everything else. I noticed the big timber benches on the way in here, ran my hand lovingly over the timber.
Yeah, that desk, the hot desk as it's called.
Yeah.
When you come into Ormabas, it's so nice. And it looks like, I don't know if it actually is, but it looks like it's kind of just cut from one huge tree, you know.
It does look like
it's
that.
It's beautiful, yeah. Really great.
And you get wonderful smells from timber.
Mm.
And there's a whole story to it, attached to it. But we get timber in from Ghana, and sometimes there'd be a wee message written from one of the natives in
Serious?
Ghana. Yeah, put a wee message on it to, you know, to whoever gets this. A bit like a message in a bottle.
Wow.
Stick it on a tree.
I was really surprised whenever you said it, the first time that you got your wood from Africa. Me being a townie and not connected to the timber industry, I was just like, well, I don't even know where the wood would have came from.
Yeah, West Coast, Ghana, Ivory Coast.
Wow.
And I mean, we used to learn all about it. Different. That's not now the done thing, if you like, because we're trying to save these timbers.
Sure.
But mahoganies and all the different. And then you get teak and so on from Malaya. Then a lot of stuff coming in from South America now.
Fascinating.
Brazilian hardwoods and things.
So what would the workforce have been like in terms of Protestant and Catholic? If we'll just go there, we'll not dance around it.
We'll go straight there. We had 200 employees on the site in Belfast,
okay.
Which was literally, we were the demarcation. We had Ballymurphy on one side and we had Spring Martin on the other side. So we were right between orange and green.
Wow.
We had 100 Catholics and 100 Protestants.
Was that intentional?
We did that. We worked at that. It didn't happen immediately, but we did work at that. But because we didn't discriminate to start with, we had a mixed workforce anyway.
Yeah.
And we were perceived as Protestant, but fair, perceived as non-political,
mm-hmm.
which we weren't. And we weren't practicing Protestant either. and we were seen as reasonable employers, I think, which was a good thing. And it was funny. People would work together, talk together, have tea together, and then in the evening, 5 o'clock, go home. Catholics turn left at the top of the gate, Protestants turn right generally. And then once people got back into their silos, then they became different, you know?
Wow. That's really crazy. I mean, there's an amazing question in there if I could find it, but I can't find it just yet. Tell me how you met your wife.
Yes, I was sailing in the west coast of Scotland, and I called into a little place called Tobermory on the Isle of Mull. And Gillian was working behind the bar, and she was at Edinburgh University, and this was her holiday job. and we began to chat, and I was actually crewing on a boat from another a chap called George Wolfe. He wanted about 6 or 7 young men at that time, fit, healthy, and we were his crew. So we all came in, and George had picked up a bucket of prawns on the way up the Sound of Mull, but with nobody to cook them. And Gillian said, well, I'll come out and cook this for you. So she came out to the boat and did all the cooking of the prawns. We had a great party that evening.
Class. So was she Scottish?
Yes, she was from Ayrshire, cool. Dunlop, where the cheese was made in Ayrshire.
How old were you whenever that was happening?
That was 20. I was 25.
Nice. Very cool. And tell me about your practical joke that sort of backfired.
Yes, I've always been into practical jokes. I don't quite know why. I think if a psychologist talked to me about it, we could probably find out why.
Yeah, we'll find the root cause.
Because sometimes humor can be used as a defensive mechanism, or it can be used as a masking mechanism.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that going on in this country, I would say. But we'll maybe get there.
Yeah. And the Belfast humor is well known.
It's wild. Yeah.
And it's a great savor of serious situations. Yeah. It's a wonderful thing. So yes, so my practical joke was that I've been going out with Gillian and dating her, coming over on the ferry, literally for the weekend, on the last and our ferry, getting the train up. She would collect me at the station, then back on Sunday evening. And this had been going on for quite a while. And then I just thought I'd play a joke on her. So I got some police-headed paper.
Okay.
And I wrote to her and said, we understand that you've been going out with a young man called Clive Curry. This young man is well known to us. He likes targeting women.
Oh, no, women. Clive, and, what have you done?
he discards them after a short while, and he's after their money and all the rest of it. And we believe that he goes out to Spain and does this as well. At the very end of all my practical jokes, I always put in something that really was so completely unbelievable, and so I put in something like, he's been caught a couple of times. On one occasion, he was using a bicycle chain, but it was from his own bike, so we caught him because he couldn't go very far without the chain, and all that. But I sent this over just as a joke, and it was all looking very official.
Yeah.
And
where'd you get the paper from?
I'll not tell you that.
You're good, Clive.
These are secrets that people like me keep. So I rang her up a couple of days later and I said, did you get a letter at all? And she said, what do you mean? And I said, no, I just wondered. She said, tell me, have you ever been to Spain? And I said, oh, yes, I go to Spain occasionally. And then it all came out. And this had caused an absolute furore in her household.
Oh, no.
Her mother, she'd shown it to her mother. Her mother said, oh, my God. They'd called round a neighbor, and they'd had all sorts of discussions about what to do. Should they phone the PSN? It was the RUC in those days.
Sure.
Should we phone the police and find out more information? And I had no idea that this had caused such a... So, yeah, it nearly broke the whole thing off.
When did you get married? Where did you get married? Did you live in Northern Ireland? How did that all work?
Yeah, we got married in Troon, and I remember, you know, all the family coming over for that. And
yeah.
That was in 1977. So we then came back to live in Northern Ireland, and Gillian and I lived in a little house in Marino. And eventually... I actually decided at that point that I'd like to go to Scotland because I felt, I wonder, am I really fit for this business? Am I here because of my name?
That's tough. That's a tough scenario to be in.
Yeah. So Gillian said, yeah, that's fine. She was quite happy that day. So off we went to Scotland, back to Scotland for her. And I worked in a company in Glasgow, timber company. Then I worked for one in Edinburgh. And eventually I actually opened up my own little business.
Oh, great.
And we were there for a year and a half, 2 years, and my eldest daughter was born in Glasgow. And then one day my brother rang me up and said, Clive, would you like to come home? Because I know you said you wanted to go away and prove yourself somewhere.
Sure,
We've now got a position. The manager of the sawmill is about to retire, a fellow called Johnson Crothers. And it's a really responsible job. And I know you wanted to have more responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I thought, this is great. So I came back and was the manager of the...
The homecoming?
Of the sawmill.
Yeah.
And I loved all of that sawing and machining and working with the guys. I loved human resources. I loved personnel and working with people. And the jokes that we had there were something else too.
That's class. So like in all this narrative of you working and, you know, your married life and you're moving forward... Like at that stage in your life, let's say 20s, 30s, maybe even 40s, like was like the term trauma even remotely on your radar? Or did you have any interest in psychology beyond HR, as you've already mentioned?
No.
Not even a drop?
No, but I've always been interested in medicine, medical things.
Okay.
So I did well at school in biology and this sort of stuff. So I've always had that strong interest. But no, I didn't have, trauma wasn't a word that I even had came across.
Which is so interesting because we are one of the trauma cities. I mean, we probably didn't know it at the time during the Troubles.
Exactly.
But we were a trauma hotspot. And again, we will get there. So how was trauma put on your radar?
Trauma came to my notice through tragedy. And that was when my wife, my late wife, Julian, got esophageal cancer in 2015. And at that point... one of my daughters came up with this concept of trauma because Gabor Mate, who is a chap that I think you know, Gabor Mate wrote the book When the Body Says No, and that's all about trauma and stress and anxiety depleting your immune system and leaving you open to disease. And I was pretty sure that my wife actually had suffered a lot of stress, and I'm pretty sure that contributed to her cancer. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really interesting. Like, I remember, I mean, it'd be hard for me to place it. I'm going to say, like, the late 2000s, early 2010s, there was so much talk about stress.
Yeah.
And, you know, stress is the killer. Stress is a... And it's so funny because, like, 10 years later, while our stress has significantly amplified, I feel like those conversations have kind of just drifted out of the public domain.
Yeah.
So, like, talk to me a little bit about the role that stress and trauma can play in depleting the immune system. How does that work on like a biological mechanism level?
Well, it's quite complicated to look at it on a biological level. Effectively, it's all to do with the chemicals that the brain produces.
Okay.
And it produces adrenaline and cortisol when you're frightened, when your body is under a threat, and they're not good for you. And the immune system just gets exhausted, basically trying to sort of put these things to bed. But we all need a bit of stress. Stress is quite good.
That's
you know,
right.
You probably feel a bit of stress sometimes whenever somebody's coming in for you to interview. Just a little bit. Keeps you keen, keeps you sharp.
Keeps you sharp, yeah.
Exactly. But everybody reacts to stress in a different way. And depending on how you react to stress and how quickly you let it get out of your system, if it leads on to anxiety, then that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And anxiety is when you start thinking of things ahead that might go wrong, as opposed to living now.
So you're out of the present.
For the moment. And we don't think of ourselves in the moment very often.
Yeah.
And I could maybe even just do something with you just now, Matthew, amenable to this.
Let's go for it.
And that's to say, I mean, your brain's probably thinking away, what's the next question? How's he answering? What else should I say?
Yeah.
But if you just simply put your hands on your knees just now.
Okay.
Put your feet flat on the ground and your knees out straight. And just think of yourself in the moment, not the future, not the past. This moment is the one moment we all have. It's here now. We have it. We're all alive. We're all well. We're all comfortable. We're warm. And in this moment, how do your feet feel? Are they comfortable? Are they throbbing slightly? Are they warm? Are they cold? And then how does the rest of your body feel? Is it in a relaxed state? Is your stomach rumbling slightly because it might be coming up to lunchtime? Mm-hmm. Are there all these other things going on? This is what you think about in your body. Now, when you do this, your brain is beginning to switch off. And in fact, this is what meditation and mindfulness is all about. And that's why they're so good for you. Because your brain's not worrying about the next thing to do. It's simply thinking about your arms, your hands, how they feel. Just think of that for a moment. And at the same time, breathe naturally and normally. Not great deep ones, but just longish breaths if you can manage. So in and out gently. And that breathing helps your body to go into a state of relaxation. So that's a very quick thing, Matthew, that I've done with you. And it I don't know how you felt at the end. Did you feel that when we were doing that?
So do you know what's interesting? Ormo Bath has got some real great community events for its members. And we all just did like an hour of yoga literally before this. So it actually took me straight back to that place where you're at the end of the session on the mat, where you're lying down, you're doing the big breaths.
Yes.
And immediately whenever we started doing an exercise, I just felt myself return to that place of just like,
Yeah, and we don't do that often enough in our lives. We lead frantic lives of what's the next thing, what's the next thing. And if we can just calm occasionally, just set aside some time each day, doesn't need to be half an hour, could be 10 minutes a day just to do that.
Well, even that, I don't know how long, let's say 2 minutes we did just there now is like powerful, you know.
That's right, yeah.
And that's something that you can do, I don't know, like when you park your car in your driveway.
Yes.
2 minutes before you get out of the car.
Exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really cool. So you said something interesting, like we don't let the stress get out of our bodies enough.
Yes.
And would you, like, this is, I'm in uncharted territory here, so please guide me and correct me, okay? Is stress that we kind of hold on to and push down, is that in a way what trauma is? Or if we scrap that and I just ask you, what is trauma? That's a better place to start.
Yes, I think we'll talk about what is trauma because it can lead on to stress and can lead on to anxiety. Trauma is a state of mind, and I need to just give a little pathology here.
Please.
Where our brains and our head, at the top of the spine is the reptilian part of our brain. And that's literally 2 million years old. Mm. It literally has not changed for 2 million years.
That's the part that if I jumped across the table and started attacking you, that you'd rip me to pieces.
Yes, but I wouldn't have thought about that.
Yeah.
That all happens automatically, autonomically. Yeah. And in fact, nearly everything that we do during the day is automatic. You're sitting there breathing, blinking, nodding your head. You're not thinking about nodding your head.
No, not at all.
You're not thinking of anything like that. 95% just goes on as an automatic, autonomic response. And that's how our brain is running our body. But yes, this reptilian part, this is the bit that is used for survival. Some people call it the saboteur. Some people call it, I prefer to call it your protector.
Yeah, because saboteur is quite a negative connotation.
It's
a very important part of your brain.
Yeah.
You need it.
Yeah.
Like, yes, it can backfire at times, but
it's
essential.
So all that sitting there, and if you have, let's say on the way into when you were walking across the Ormo Road today, and a bus nearly knocked you down, and it was a blue bus, and that would be, all your senses pick that up, sound, sight, hearing, everything, and even the rush of air as it went past you. Now, your brain will remember that sequence, that template. And the next time you go to walk across the road and a blue bus approaches, your back, the back of your limbic system starts to go, just a minute, hold on, Matthew. The last time this happened, you jolly nearly lost your life. We're not going to risk that again.
Mm.
So it immediately puts your muscles onto hold and says, stop right there. Your brain, which is your prefrontal cortex, your thinking part, doesn't have any say in that whatsoever.
Wow. And so that example you gave of a physical threat, that then is the same mechanism that could happen, say, in more of a social setting.
Absolutely.
And that's where we can get into real difficulty because we're having this automatic response to, I don't know, like someone walking through a door or someone reaching for something from their handbag and you can just go from 0 to 100 straight away.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of things happen, like anger responses, you get a trauma response. It's a survival instinct.
Mm.
Now, with that survival instinct, they talk about it having sort of three components, fight, flight, or freeze.
Wow.
And if you look at that on the sort of the David Attenborough films or the jungle and whatever, and you see a deer being hunted by a leopard or whatever, as soon as the leopard comes up or the twig snaps, the deer immediately stops and looks around. And then it suddenly sees the leopard. It's got a choice of fight, flight, or freeze.
Mm.
Now, freeze is one of the it's a coping mechanism you can use. So it'll almost certainly go for flight. and off it goes and the leopard's in pursuit. If the leopard catches it, just as it catches it, it might go into freeze. And I've seen videos of this where it falls down completely limp, looks as if it's dead. And the leopard goes, oh, what happened there? I didn't catch it around the throat the way I normally do, but it's okay. You know?
Yeah.
And the leopard loses interest, walks away a bit, and the next thing it's up and away.
Amazing.
And so that was a very, very good survival mechanism.
Yeah.
Of course, fight is a different thing. If you get rats, for example, in a corner, they will often jump out, and that's the fight response that they've got.
So annoying. I used to live in New York City, and frequently I would walk home on my street, on 191st Street in St. Nicholas, and if it was trash day, as they say, you know, there would be rats running around, and they would jump up your legs and stuff, because yeah. They would get so frightened. You're like, leave me alone, I'm just trying to get home.
Yeah.
So go back slightly, and this is the last time I will go back. So Gillian passes away in 2016.
Yeah.
What gave you, your daughter had kind of like, while the sickness was happening, had alluded to trauma.
Yeah.
What then set you on the journey, or after Gillian passed, what did you kind of do next?
Well, she mentioned Gabor Mate. She'd come across him on a website.
Cool.
And I looked up his book, and I read that. And I also read Dr. Peter Levine's book, Waking the Tiger, which is all about the same thing. And then I got onto Bessel van der Kolk. And I read about 50 books whilst I was looking after her in that 9-month period. And that gave me so much knowledge about this. And I thought, I've got to tell the world, certainly Northern Ireland, about this, to try and prevent this happening again. Because nobody should lose their wife or loved one because of an illness that didn't need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what I was doing. I wanted to tell. And I started off by going over to other conferences, sitting in the front row. I would wear a pink shirt and a cream jacket so that I was recognizable. And I'd leap up onto the stage at the end of the talk and I'd say, would you come to Northern Ireland in 2018 and give a talk on trauma? And they nearly always looked at me and said, oh, yes, I'd love to come to Northern Ireland.
Incredible.
And they all came.
And like, just like for people listening who maybe aren't familiar with some of the names you've thrown around, I actually didn't know this. The fact that Gabor Mate walked the streets of Belfast, I'm a wee bit starstruck even thinking that was in 2018.
Yeah.
Like, you know, these are like people at the absolute top of their field.
Yeah.
Highly, highly in demand. Like, we'll just call them celebrities because that is really what they are.
Yeah.
And the fact that you were able to bring some of these people to this place is just, it's absolutely remarkable. It's really fun as well.
Absolutely. And they love being here. And we had a great dinner when they were here. And a lot of them will come back. Of course, COVID knocked it on the head last year, which was going to be our sort of every 2-year sequence. But we had a virtual one instead. And Karen, who is the life and soul of Action Trauma, she worked with me and the team, and we got a virtual conference going, and it was very, very successful.
Mm. So let's talk about a term that I have heard thrown around my whole life. So this is, again, where our two stories are very different. I've grown up, and I would say since I've been about, let's call it, at secondary school age, the term intergenerational trauma.
Yeah.
Unpack that for me slightly and we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, I'd also like to add to it.
Please do.
Because there are traumas that, I'll just go back very quickly to what trauma is. We talked about it being something that's in your template that makes you respond.
Good catch, Clive. We didn't close the loop. I appreciate that.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
So that, and it's something that you it takes control of you without you knowing about it.
Mm-hmm.
That can be caused by things other than just a fright or a shock. It can be caused by poor attachment with your mother. There could be all sorts of reasons for that. Maybe mother and father broke up. A lot of children feel that they're responsible for the breakup of their parents. Mm-hmm. They actually take it personally.
Absolutely.
And feel ashamed and guilty that they caused it in some way, even though they didn't.
Yeah. How did I not keep it together, says the 12-year-old.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. So that sort of stuff goes on. So there's a lot of traumas or trauma responses that aren't necessarily caused by a single incident trauma. Mm-hmm. They're caused by a buildup of stuff. So that's what effectively goes on. Now, come back. What was that question again to me?
Intergenerational. Before we go there, I'll stay here for a little bit longer because you've triggered some other things.
Yeah.
I actually was listening to a podcast with my wife 2 weeks ago. It was a married couple and they were talking about big T and little T.
Yeah.
Big trauma and little trauma. And the point that they were making is that whenever you have experienced a big trauma in your life, car accident, a divorce, a whatever, mm-hmm. very often little traumas in your life can send you back to that kind of sky right. high escalated level.
Tip you over, yeah.
Talk to me a wee bit about that, because I think this is an area now where people who are listening will be able to identify in their own lives of, oh, someone cut me off and I've literally just gone back to a 10 out of 10 anger response to that.
Yeah.
Or maybe my partner has given me some constructive feedback in a way, and it just takes me back to what that person said to me when I was this age, and boom, all of a sudden they're exploding. You
exactly.
know?
Yeah. Well, look, it is a very complex area. We've been working and studying this for years and years and years, but essentially you probably can't do it on your own, because mm-hmm. this trauma is held in the back of your brain in the limbic system. That's all automatic. It's in your unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Your conscious, which is the prefrontal cortex over the front and top half of your head, that's your thinking part that knows that I'm Clive and that's Karen and you're Matthew and we're in a studio. That thinking part can't get involved. It just cannot communicate properly with the limbic system.
Okay.
So there are things that you can do, like hypnosis,
mm-hmm.
where you can get straight in there, or various other techniques of being able to get into the back and try and address this. But most people don't want you to go there.
They're afraid of the black magic.
Yeah, the yeah. Pandora's box lid. Don't undo that catch or the lid will burst
exactly.
off. All that stuff's going to come out.
Yeah.
Oh my God, no.
So the stuff you've been bottling your whole life.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you can go there with professional help.
Mm-hmm.
If it's done well, you have to have complete trust in the person that you're talking to. And you also need to feel safe when mm-hmm. you're doing it. So those are the two main factors. When you go there with a psychotherapist, psychologist or whatever, they will help to bring you back, begin to look at this unconscious memory and eventually put it to bed, put it to rest quietly so that it doesn't affect you in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it does take, and there are different ways of doing this. Some succeed with some people, some don't, but there are lots of ways of doing it.
Okay. That's very interesting.
So coming back now to the different types of trauma, you can have trauma that's inherited actually in your genes.
Mm-hmm.
And that can come down maybe two or three generations.
Wow.
But you can also have it from trauma that you've picked up from just hearing your parents talking about it. So even hearing me talking about the troubles, that's a sort of an intergenerational trauma, because you're right. identifying with it by word of mouth.
And you're thinking, oh, I can't believe that happened to my granda. Oh, my goodness. And your brain goes.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, then you move on to other areas like group or gang trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move on to community trauma, where the community is traumatized. So all of those people I mentioned in maybe Ballymurphy or in Spring Martin, mm-hmm. in the two orange and green areas, they would have had probably a community trauma from incidents that happened within their area.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they self-fulfill, so they go in and talk about it, and it's, you know, and this is the difficulty where you try and break that out and try and bring it back down. And this is why maybe things like meditation can help, but also we need to begin to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my little babies is segregated schooling. I don't think segregated schooling is great. I think we need to be able to meet at the youngest age possible, share experiences, live with other people, learn how they live their lives, their community live their lives. And then from that point on, we can begin to come together.
So what you said about trauma being held at the back of the brain, did you say the limbic system?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
In the subconscious. Is that what is that what Bessel means whenever he says the body keeps the score?
Yes.
So while your brain doesn't clock it and your brain doesn't keep it, your body remembers.
Yes, the body remembers.
So let's say I'm not aware of that.
Yeah.
It's in my body. Yeah. I've heard people use terms like, there's trauma in your body. I'm always like, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
You've explained to me sort of what that is. What are the symptoms that myself or people listening could identify in their lives if there is a lot of trauma kind of kept back there?
Well, you could have all sorts of symptoms. Some of them will be very obvious. They could be nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
They could be intrusive thoughts, all the time intrusive thoughts. They could be increasing heart rate, breath palpitations, where you That's a trauma symptom. That's a response. All of those can happen. You can then also have lots of other stuff like high blood pressure, tinnitus, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, frequent urination. There's a whole lot of stuff that goes on that's all part of this. And of course, addictions.
Interesting.
You're wanting me to get to addictions probably.
Do you know what? I was crying out for it. I didn't even know I wanted it until I saw you going down that road and it goes, oh my word, we can talk about addictions in this episode. Let's go.
Yeah. So that's the big, big downside of trauma.
And when you say addiction, is this more so that people are self-medicating against their trauma by using anything you can become addicted
well,
to?
Well, you see, it's not so much against their trauma. What they're trying to do, we've all got our central nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
The central nervous system is aroused and unhappy because of what's going on with the traumas.
Okay.
So you need something to help it ease, to resolve it, to make it feel more comfortable, a coping strategy. And sometimes alcohol can do that.
Something to make it go away for a while.
But it's not necessarily. The thing is that addictions covers all sorts of stuff, including food.
Sure.
Sex addiction.
Yeah, which pornography. Is massive. At the
all of that sort of stuff. That's all part of the addictive behavior that makes your system, if not feel better, it certainly is an outlet for it.
Yeah. Video games would be a good example.
Yeah.
Get the anger out.
Yeah.
Shoot people on the screen.
And yes, then of course you've got the medication, whether it's alcohol or substances or anything like that, and that all helps people to get out of their system what they feel, you know, to help their system cope.
Yeah,
and of course that moves on to things like suicides, self-harming, and all of these really really tragic things that happen.
And the brutality of addiction is that you start to try, you know, you start the behavior or you start taking the substance or whatever it is to try and get out of your system, as you say, or distract yourself from the pain or numb the pain. And then a little bit down that journey, you start to continue the behavior, not even to feel pleasure anymore, but to make the pain of not doing the activity go away.
Yeah.
And that's whenever you start getting into just real, real crazy sort of territory.
Yeah.
So we may have actually answered this, but this is something that I wanted to kind of talk about. We as the Northern Irish community.
Yes.
You know, we said earlier, and this was your lovely thing that you sent through, that we are one of the trauma cities, along with Beirut. I think
it was. Beirut. Yeah, other cities. Yeah.
What happened in Beirut? I don't know. Shame on me.
Well, it's a Middle Eastern conflict where, you know, there were thousands of people killed.
Wow.
It's happening in Palestine just now.
Mm.
So any areas where you've got large groups of people against other groups and you get genocides and all of these sorts of things happening.
Wow. When I was 18, I was going to say this earlier, I spent 3 months in Rwanda.
Right.
And we were doing a lot of work and hearing a lot of stories and meeting a lot of people that were connected to the genocide.
Yeah.
Do you know what's crazy? Even at that age, whenever I didn't know the stuff I know now, I was struck by how similar, and use that word broadly, Rwanda was to Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what you've said. It's the two community kind of trauma.
Yeah.
So what do you think are some of the hang-ups that we as a community face because of our trauma? What's some of the negative impact that we are living out today, a couple of generations later, due to the conflict we've had?
Well, exactly what you mentioned earlier. It's about the loss of temper, the anger that goes on, and then the drinking.
It does strike me that we are perhaps more vulnerable to addiction than other places in the world. This is something I've observed, but I've never had a working thesis for why.
Yeah,
you know?
No, definitely. That's the case. And also the fact that communities are taking sides against another community. That's not healthy to be doing that, but it happens. And it's a sort of an inbuilt thing that we seem to just not be able to get out of.
And I've never once thought about this in my life until this conversation. There's also a repeating of the trauma. And what I mean by that is we retell stories over and over and over and over. And then our kids retell those stories exactly. over and over. It's yeah. plastered on the walls of our buildings.
Yeah.
It's surrounded us everywhere we go. It's the trauma repeated in front of us, but it's not being dealt with.
Yeah.
It's not being, you're not moving forward from that. You're just stuck in that kind of cycle, which has got to have some
impact. But there are some words that we need to start bringing into the equation now. And one of those is love, and another is compassion. And understanding is the third one, but probably the biggest word is compassion, where we, compassion is such a powerful word because it means that you can forgive somebody for doing what happened to you because you know that they didn't, it wasn't personal. Mm. They didn't do it because they didn't like you. They did it because they've got their own issues going on in their own lives, mm-hmm. maybe from the intergenerational, maybe from other things, and that's why they did it. And when you can begin to think of that, you're beginning to forgive them because you now know that it wasn't their fault. It wasn't your fault either. And fault, blame, shame, mm-hmm. guilt, these are all so destructive.
Mm-hmm.
But yet compassion is so constructive.
Yeah.
And love is so constructive. Love, not in the romantic sense, just simply loving somebody because you like them, what they do. They make you feel good. You make them feel good. Mm-hmm. All that sort of stuff. And when you can do that, I mean, I'm a hugaholic, which I've been, this has been public for a while. But at the end of our first conference in 2018, about 80 different ladies came up and hugged me and said, thanks very much for running this conference.
Mm.
And I felt so good. I mean, I'm actually getting choking now telling about this. But I just felt so good that we were able to make so many people feel better.
Yeah.
It's a very, very powerful. And that's one of the things. Sorry, I'm moving on to another side. But that's what COVID's done to us.
That's what the show is all about.
It stopped us touching. It stopped us socializing, interacting in the way that we need as human beings. We need social interaction. We need touch. We need people to hug us.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, and that brings us on to grief. Because with COVID, people die and you couldn't bury them
no
properly.
Closure. No wake. No usual rituals that are associated with it.
And you need all of that to be able to mourn that person passing and for you to process the grief.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, we've covered a lot of things very quickly there.
But I love it.
They're all part of it.
It's brilliant. A quick story. I obviously went through all the lockdowns, as all of us in the room and listening have. And then about, was it last month or the month before that, I got COVID. Our whole family got it. And so we had to do our 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
in isolation. And it was crazy. I felt on a physical level, almost like a re-traumatization of, please don't make me go back to the lockdown.
Yeah.
It was only 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But I really had to hold myself and be very aware of kind of how I was feeling. It's like, you know, this is not another long lockdown. And it's really interesting. It was only after that experience that I realized, whoa, I found the lockdowns really hard. Because I kind of just got on with it and we were in kind of like military mode as a nation and we will get through this and blah, 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 blah. But it's interesting how like being exposed to it again made me feel like, whoa, this was so traumatic for us as a nation. And like, what's the impact of this going to be like going forward?
Yeah.
You know, we had a baby during one of the lockdowns and, you know, it's interesting for her and for her peers. You know, she just turned one. We're all just kind of looking eagerly. We're like, you know, like, how are you going to be different from the rest of us? You know, has a lack of interacting with other people at this young age, you know, is it going to impact you in any way? It's all just very, very interesting.
We can just, I'll pick you up on that point because we talked about attachment earlier and attachment difficulties.
Yeah.
Attachment with young children is so important from the moment they're born to looking into their mum's eyes and feeling their mum's skin and feeding and so on. And that is so, so important. And if you get good attachment, it stands you in very, very good stead throughout the rest of your life.
Yeah. And that's the flip side of the COVID equation for us is that we got to have and continue to have so much intimacy with our daughter.
Yes.
That perhaps we wouldn't have to the same intensity in an open world, in the normal world.
Yeah, that's true. There have been benefits. And that's one of them. You're absolutely right.
We're just going to go into like a realm of like impossible questions, okay? And these are not questions that can have answers. I just want to hear kind of thoughts and ideas and kind of working concepts. You know, if I was to appoint you as like chief de-traumatizer of Northern Ireland, right? Like, how would you go about to start to unravel some of our country's trauma? What are some of the things that need to be put in place? What are some of the stuff that needs to happen? Like, I apologize for the appalling question, but I just would love to hear some of your thoughts.
Well, I did mention earlier on integrated education. Mm. I think from the get-go, it's good to know how the other half lives, if you like. Mm. And I think integrated education would be absolutely first on my list.
And even a step further. So I found this out the other day and it blew my mind. You maybe know this better than me. There is a primary school on the Lisburn Road called Fane Street Primary School, F-A-N-E. And the way it was communicated to me, there are over 60 different countries represented in that primary school.
Wow.
On the Lisburn Road. And I just thought, like, you know, we live in Dromore, and part of me just went, I would love to send my daughter there. Like, yes. What a great experience it would be, yes, to be a part of that. You know,
yes,
what I mean?
Yes.
And as Northern Ireland is changing and it's moving beyond just the two sides, mm-hmm, it's more becoming very multifaceted.
Yeah.
You know, I think integrated education in every sense of the term.
Yeah.
We've had Baroness May Blood on the show before.
Yeah.
I'm a believer, you know, I'm sold. I believe in it.
Well, move that. That's a brilliant idea. I mean, I think that singing and community activities are very important.
Why do you say singing? You put a real emphasis on singing there.
Yeah, well, singing is very, very good because it's got, there's the breath element.
Yeah.
You feel good with the noise going out. It actually helps all sorts of things, which Stephen Porges could tell you about in terms of his polyvagal theory. So all that resonating that goes on, but it's the breathing out. It's also the fact that you're doing it in company with other people.
Mm.
So if I had this magic wand, I would have large group singing sessions.
Yeah.
Regularly to take over Titanic and take over the Waterfront Hall and whatever,
yeah,
and have these. And look, we've got all these people like Van Morrison and so on,
sure,
who are from here, who, yeah, could lead all of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they would actually help us all to feel better. And we would do various other things in between, telling people about breathing and so on.
Yeah.
So they were, and make it mixed community, absolutely, mm-hmm, mixed community for all of this stuff.
Well, if anything, I mean, there's just an extra excuse. Now the world has opened up again to go to more concerts.
Well,
go
not?
See your favorite band and belt it out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think we could also do some group meditation and mindfulness. Again, training people. When I say training, showing by example how this can help.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to. But it would require a lot of organization and a lot of planning and getting it all done in time and whatever.
Mm-hmm. One little point, because it'll annoy me if I don't get it out. I'm always fascinated by... Or I'm fascinated whenever science sort of catches up to ancient wisdom, like stuff that's just taken for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it so interesting that in every single people group on the planet, like, singing together has found a way,
yeah,
into its core.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting, you know, whether you are religious or not, I say you to the listener and you to you, Clive.
Yeah.
It's interesting how as we as a nation have moved away from everyone goes to church, everyone's part of a choir,
yeah,
there are things that we have lost along the way,
mm-hmm,
that were always baked into kind of human culture. So yeah,
yeah,
singing, yeah, really, really cool.
And let me add to that, as a baby again, attachment, lullabies.
Really?
Singing to your baby is hugely impactful and powerful and helpful to the baby.
Wow.
Even just humming, if you can't sing, hum.
My wife's German, and so she sings this beautiful kind of German lullaby to,
yeah,
my daughter, and I don't know the words, so I just hum it, and it does the trick. She still falls asleep.
Absolutely.
But I don't know the, yeah, German words, so that's, yeah, my kind of cheat sheet. Well, okay, so like you said, huge complexity to roll that out on a nationwide level.
Mm.
Let's make it slightly easier then. On the individual level, like for the person listening,
mm-hmm,
how can they embark on a journey to start to deal with the trauma in their own lives? Give me a couple of different...
I'm going to come back to this word compassion.
Yeah.
It's so powerful. And that means compassion for yourself. So go and Google it. Look it up. There's a fellow called Dr. Paul Gilbert, who's got all sorts of compassionate-focused therapy, and mm-hmm. Gabor Mate does that too. And get some compassion for yourself, first of all. And that means forgiving yourself for not being too hard on yourself. Go there and say, well, there were reasons why we did that. And okay, let's go forward now and see if we can help other people. And use compassion. Judgmentalism is a big problem. You know, you see somebody in the street, maybe sleeping rough, and you say, oh, they're a mess. Their life must be a mess. That person has had, they are alive. They've got their own life. Mm-hmm. They've got their own history. They need help and compassion in particular. And if you can give them that compassion, they will possibly be able to respond and maybe come back. You don't know why they're there, but think about compassion first.
Mm. And there's something really interesting that goes on there. I think the term is self-signaling,
mm-hmm.
where whenever you judge another person for doing an action, you're also judging yourself if you do that same action.
That's right.
So I think a classic example is, if you believe that people who smoke cigarettes
mm-hmm.
are bad, okay, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. something as broad as that, if then you start smoking cigarettes, mm-hmm. your own brain will say, oh, you're so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And or if you see someone driving a really flashy car and you say, like, oh, like, what a show off.
Mm-hmm.
You're also telling yourself you can never drive a flashy car, because if you do, you're just going to be this terrible person.
Yeah.
So it is like the compassion is a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
And the less you can judge, actually, the less you judge other people, the easier you will find it to not judge yourself as well, which is big. And I think the Northern Irish mindset is extremely critical of itself.
Yeah. That's right. That's very profound, Matthew.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
We'll have to get you into our think tank.
Mate, I'm all up for it. I'm all up for it. Anything else you would recommend people who, after listening to this, they can say, okay, I think I've identified there's some trauma in my life. It could be, you know, how any places you would point them to or any things they could do to start to unpack that?
There's a range of different treatments, and we call it healing.
Sure.
And I think that it would be difficult to pick any out just now, but there mm-hmm. are lots of different healing modalities, we call them.
Okay.
And
let me do this then.
Yeah.
You've read over 50 books and probably a lot more since. Mm-hmm. If you were to recommend one book as a jumping off point in the trauma, which one would you recommend?
I think that Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score,
mm-hmm.
is probably a good entree to letting you know about all the different types of trauma, be it war veterans or whatever. He also has a very open mind as to the different types of treatment available.
Mm-hmm.
And he does all sorts of different therapies and has tried all sorts of different therapies. So I think he's probably the one. If you wanted to be a bit more specific, if you've got something like addictions or ADHD or any of those sorts of things, Gabor Mate would be a good one there. And of course, you've got Dr. Peter Levine, who probably was one of the very, very first ones to do all of this. And his books are very good. Waking the Tiger is a start, but he's done a number of other books.
Those are three, really. I'll put a link to those three books mm-hmm. in the show notes.
Yeah.
So if you're listening and you'd like to have a look at any of them, if you just look at the episode description where you're listening, you can click a link and it'll take you straight there.
One little throwaway thing I'd like to say is that trauma is not an illness. It's an injury which can be healed.
Now it's your turn to be profound.
And always keep hope alive. The brain is very plastic. And neuroplasticity is well known. The little, you know, when you look at the grass and you see where a rabbit has been running along, it created a little track in the grass.
Yeah.
The brain's like that. You change the track, run along it a bit more, you get a new track.
Wow.
So the brain will, and doesn't matter what age you are, 19 or 90.
Yeah.
It's just as plastic and it can be changed, and hope must always be there. Never, never lose hope.
Wow, that's gorgeous. Say that again. Trauma is not a disease.
No, it's not an illness.
Not an illness. It's an injury.
It's an injury
that can be recovered from. Wow. That is so good. You need that quote up on a wall somewhere, don't you? That's fantastic. With Clive, like, I could sit here and talk to you all day. There's a series of stock questions that we kind of have asked every, I don't know what we are now, like 200 people we've talked to.
Yeah.
They are simple yet possibly profound. We'll see what happens. I love asking people, what has been the most challenging moment of your journey so far, and how were you able to overcome it?
The most challenging moment was probably, in fact, I won't say probably, was. Probably is a word that we use to buffer.
It is, yeah. It's a coper, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was the death of my wife, Gillian. Mm-hmm. So that was the worst. Both the trauma of helping her and the treatments and so on that ultimately failed, mm-hmm. And then afterwards the grief. But here again, of all of these things, I've been on a learning curve. Working with the trauma mm-hmm. has all been therapeutic and cathartic for me. And in any form of grief, there are books about the five different sort of levels of grief, the five stages. There's just been a book written about the sixth stage, which is that you attribute meaning to the death or the loss. And I think with what I'm doing with Action Trauma, I've been able to attribute meaning to Gillian's death, that what she didn't die in vain, if you like. Something
yes.
good has come out of it.
Absolutely.
The learning that we've got and the help that we're able to give to others, and I think she'd be very proud of that.
That is very, very profound. The sixth stage of grief. And I was saying to a friend the other day, the reason why I do what I do in terms of talking to people in podcasts is because the thing that excites me is that light bulb moment when someone puts language to your lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, I'm like, oh, this is why I'm sitting here with this microphone.
Yeah.
And I've lost a few friends to suicide over the years.
Yeah.
And I have experienced that sense of meaning of,
yeah.
well, let's make sure it's not for nothing.
Yeah.
And again, you've unlocked the whole world for me now. I feel like I see the world through different lenses. You know, it's also why you see a lot of those community walks to raise money for dementia or cancer
yes.
or leukemia yes. or whatever. Because, okay, let's make sure this wasn't for nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really...
And I mean, just talking about that, suicide and suicidal ideation, self-harm is very often a lead-in to suicide.
Yeah.
So one needs to be very aware of that. Suicide itself is something which is a coping strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very effective coping strategy.
Yeah.
The trouble is it's permanent.
Yeah.
So unlike the alcohol that you can take and you can stop, once you've done that, made that final decision, it's too late. So it is a coping strategy. It takes all the pressure off the central nervous system because it was just creaking and groaning under all these other anxieties.
Yeah.
So there are other ways of doing that. And as you know, there are lots of help. There's lots of help out there. Lift the phone mm-hmm. and ring and get some help and advice. And it's amazing when people even just say, this is actually a coping strategy that you've got.
Yeah.
It can make people say, oh, gosh. And I talked to a man who stood on a bridge in Newcastle upon Tyne. He's now written a book and he's leading the world in terms of helping people with trauma.
That's great.
And he stood on a bridge and he was about to jump and a bus was coming underneath. He thought, I better stop because the bus is going to run over me. And he said, what am I doing? So standing up on this bridge.
That is crazy how the brain works.
Yeah. And ever since then, he's been working with people and helping them to recover.
Wow. You touched on something really important there. You know, it almost the guilt or the shame around suicidal ideation,
yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
for people to know. I mean, it's the cliches, but the cliches are very powerful. It's okay not to be okay.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm trying to spin
and
it around.
And remember that
in my
it's
head.
Still this injury which can be healed.
Yeah.
It's not forever.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's always hope.
Yeah. Permanent solution to temporary problems, isn't
yeah,
that what they say?
Exactly.
Very good.
Yeah.
Most proudest moment. So far?
The proudest moment probably would be the, again, probably. Would, it would be.
I like how you're self aware. I'll give you
I
that.
Catch myself
you caught on. It. You caught it, yeah.
It would be the at the end of the trauma summit in 2018. When I looked around and saw, you know, sort of 2,000 people, all these speakers there, all come together to help each other. And yet I'd been the little the bit that had put them all together and got that, you know, the catalyst, if you like, that had brought it together. So that would probably be my proudest moment.
Fantastic.
Apart from having my children.
Great.
Because when they were born, each of those would have been the proudest moment at the time for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I know it's always hard. I need to start caveating, like, aside from, you know, close family stuff, because that all, it obviously does trump everything. But
yeah.
If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a cup of tea, who would you take? Where would you take them and why?
Anyone in Northern Ireland. It would be Stephen Hughes, who works with young people in the troubled areas, helping to keep them out of gangs, helping to give them advice. And to me, he is a hero. Mm. And leading by example with his compassion and love for people, bringing all these young people together from different communities, persuading them not to go out at night and join gangs, I think that would be the one person I would take.
Fantastic. Final question, Clive. If you could go back in time to a 18-year-old version of yourself, standing on top of the roof, listening to all the gunshots, and you could have like a couple of minutes of his time, or you could send a message to him on the side of a piece of timber or something, what advice would you give that 18-year-old?
I would say carry on doing the best you can in life, knowing that one day all these people who are shooting each other will learn to shake hands. Mm. Now, that's still a long way off.
Sure.
And I'm not gone yet, so I'm 70 now. But I'd love to see that happening.
Yeah. There is a bonus question that we throw in because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Mm. What is the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
The kindest thing that someone has ever done. Yes, I was with my mother in London when I was about 8, and we were visiting some relatives, and we went down to the tube, onto the tube system, and we were both in a tube train, and the automatic doors opened. My mother stepped out, and as the doors began to close, I wouldn't step out. And that was my survival instinct.
Yeah, yeah, the freeze.
So the doors closed. My mother was running alongside the platform. No. And aged 8, I was heading off on the tube. And a man beside me said, "Don't worry, Sonny, we'll get off at the next station." And he took me off at the next station. We left a message that if my mother was to arrive at the next station, to tell her that we'd gone back.
Yeah.
And he then took me back to the previous station.
Yeah.
And we waited there. And in fact, my mother had got on the next train and gone up. She got the message, came back, and we were reunited.
Wow.
So that man, I think, was the kindest thing he ever did.
Incredible. Clive, I can't thank you enough. This has been personally very interesting and a lovely way to spend an hour. So thank you so much for your time.
Matthew, I think this is the best interview I've ever had. And I commend you for your not only your ability to get out of me all the things that you've got out of me, but your knowledge and your interest and your compassion has been second to none.